17. As dusk ended and night deepened, Roland sat on the edge of the bandstand and watched the Kalafokan tuck into their great dinner. Every one of them knew it might be the last meal they'd ever eat together. That tomorrow night at this time their nice little town might lie in smoking ruins all about them, but still, they were cheerful. And not, Roland thought, entirely for the sake of the children. There was great relief in finally deciding to do the right thing. Even when folk knew the price was apt to be high, that relief came. A kind of giddiness. Most of these people would sleep on the green tonight, with their children and grandchildren in the tent nearby, and here they would stay. Their faces turned to the northeast of town, waiting for the outcome of the battle. There would be gunshots, they reckoned. It was a sound many of them had never heard. And then the dust cloud that marked the wolves would either dissipate, turn back the way it had come, or roll on toward town. If the last, the Falcon would scatter and wait for the burning to commence. When it was over, they would be refugees in their own place. Would they rebuild if that was how the cards fell? Roland doubted it. With no children to build for, because the wolves would take them all this time if they won, the gunslinger did not doubt it, there would be no reason. At the end of the next cycle, this place would be a ghost town.
Cry your pardon, Si.
Roland looked around. There stood Wayne Overholzer with his hat in his hands. Standing thus, he looked more like a wandering saddle tramp down on his luck than the Kala's big farmer. His eyes were large and somehow mournful.
No need to cry my pardon when I'm still wearing the Dayrider hat you gave me, Roland said mildly.
Yar, but...
Overholzer trailed off, thought of how he wanted to go on, and then seemed to decide to fly straight at it.
Reuben Cavera was one of the fellows you meant to take to guard the children during the fight, wasn't he?
Aye.
His gut busted this morning.
Overholzer touched his own swelling belly about where his appendix might have been.
He lays home feverish and raving. He'll likely die of the blood muck. Some get better, aye, but not many.
I'm sorry to hear it, Roland said, trying to think who would be best to replace Cavera, a hulk of a man who had impressed Roland as not knowing much about fear and probably nothing at all about cowardice.
Take me instead, would you?
Roland eyed him.
Please, gunslinger. I can't stand aside. I thought I could, that I must, but I can't. It's making me sick.
And yes, Roland thought, he did look sick.
Does your wife know, Wayne?
Aye.
And says I? She does.
Roland nodded.
Be here half an hour before dawn.
A look of intense, almost painful gratitude filled Overholzer's face and made him look weirdly young.
Thank ye, Roland. Say thank ye. Big, big.
Glad to have you. Now listen to me a minute.
Aye?
Things won't be just the way I told them at the big meeting.
Because of Andy, you mean?
Yes, partly that.
What else?
You don't mean to say there's another traitor, do you?
You don't mean to say that.
All I mean to say is that if you want to come with us, you have to roll with us, do you ken?
Yes, Roland, very well.
Overholzer thanked him again for the chance to die north of town, and then hurried off with his hat still in his hands. Before Roland could change his mind, perhaps. Eddie came over.
Overholzer's coming to the dance?
Looks like it. How much trouble did you have with Andy?
It went all right,
Eddie said, not wanting to admit that he, Tien, and Rosalita had probably all come within a second of being toast. In the distance they could still hear him bellowing. But probably not for much longer. The amplified voice was claiming shutdown was 79% complete.
I think he did very well.
A compliment from Roland always made Eddie feel like king of the world, but he tried not to show it.
As long as we do well tomorrow.
Susanna?
Seems fine.
No. Roland rubbed above his left eyebrow.
No, not that I've seen.
And no talking short and sharp?
No, she's good for it. Practiced with her plates all the time you guys were digging.
Eddie tipped his chin toward Jake, who was sitting by himself on a swing with Oi at his feet.
That's the one I'm worried about. I'll be glad to get him out of here. This has been hard for him.
It'll be harder on the other boy, Roland said, and stood up. I'm going back to Pears.
Going to get some sleep. Can you sleep?
Oh, yes, Roland said. With the help of Rosa's cat oil, I'll sleep like a rock. You and Susanna and Jake should also try.
Okay. Roland nodded somberly. I'll wake you tomorrow morning.
We'll ride down here together.
And we'll fight.
Yes, Roland said.
He looked at Eddie. His blue eyes gleamed in the glow of the torches.
We'll fight. Until they're dead, or we are.
Chapter 7 The Wolves 1
See this now. See it very well. Here is a road, as wide and as well maintained as any secondary road in America, but of the smooth-packed dirt the Kala folk call Ogun. Ditches for runoff border both sides. Here and there, neat and well-maintained wooden culverts run beneath the Ogun. In the faint, unearthly light that comes before dawn, a dozen bucka wagons, they are the kind driven by the Manny with rounded canvas tops, roll along the road. The canvas is bright, clean white, to reflect the sun and keep the interiors cool on hot summer days, and they look like strange, low-floating clouds. The cumulus kind, may it do you. Each wagon is drawn by a team of 6 mules or 4 horses. On the seat of each, driving, are either a pair of fighters or of designated childminders. Overholzer is driving the lead wagon, with Margaret Eisenhart beside him. Next in line comes Roland of Gilead, mated with Ben Slightman. 5th is Tian and Zelia Jaffords. 7th is Eddie and Susanna Dean. Susanna's wheelchair is folded up in the wagon behind her. Bucky and Annabel Javier are in charge of the 10th. On the peak seat of the last wagon are Father Donald Callahan and Rosalita Munoz. Inside the buckas are 99 children. The leftover twin, the one that makes for an odd number, is Benny Slightman, of course. He is riding in the last wagon. He felt uncomfortable about going with his father. The children don't speak. Some of the younger ones have gone back to sleep. They will have to be awakened shortly when the wagons reach their destination. Ahead, now less than a mile, is the place where the path into the Arroyo country splits off to the left. On the right, the land runs down a mild slope to the river. All the drivers keep looking to the east, toward the constant darkness that is Thunderclap. They are watching for an approaching dust cloud. There is none. Not yet. Even the Seminon winds have fallen still. Callahan's prayers seem to have been answered, at least in that regard. 2. Ben Slightman, sitting next to Roland on the bucka's peak seat, spoke in a voice so low the gunslinger could barely hear him.
What will he do to me, then?
If asked, when the wagons set out from Kala Bryn Sturgis, to give odds on Slightman's surviving this day, Roland might have put them at 5 in 100. Surely no better. There were 2 crucial questions that needed to be asked and then answered correctly. The first had to come from Slightman himself. Roland hadn't really expected the man to ask it, but here it was, out of his mouth. Roland turned his head and looked at him. Von Eisenhart's foreman was very pale, but he took off his spectacles and met Roland's gaze. The gunslinger ascribed no special courage to this. Surely Slightman the Elder had had time to take Roland's measure and knew that he must look the gunslinger in the eye if he was to have any hope at all, little as he might like to do it.
"Yar, I know," Slightman said. His voice was steady, at least so far.
"Know what?
That you know."
"Have since we took your pard, I suppose," Roland said. The word was deliberately sarcastic. Sarcasm was the only form of humor Roland truly understood, and Slightman winced at it. "Pard. Your pard." But he nodded, eyes still steady on Roland's.
"I had to figure that if you knew about Andy, he knew about me. Although he'd never have peached on me, such wasn't in his programming."
At last it was too much, and he could bear the eye contact no longer. He looked down, biting his lip.
"Mostly I knew because of Jake. Roland wasn't able to keep the surprise out of his face. He changed. He didn't mean to, not as trig as he is, and as brave, but he did. Not toward me, toward my boy. Over the last week and a half. Then he was only, well, puzzled, I guess you'd say. He felt something, but didn't know what it was. I did. It was like your boy didn't want to be around him anymore. I asked myself what could do that. The answer seemed pretty clear. Clear as short beer, do you?
Roland was falling behind Overholzer's wagon. He flicked the reins over the backs of his own team. They moved a little faster. From behind them came the quiet sound of the children, some talking now, but most snoring, and the muted jingle of Trace. He'd asked Jake to collect up a small box of children's possessions, and had seen the boy doing it. He was a good boy who never put off a chore. This morning he wore a day rider hat to keep the sun out of his eyes and his father's gun. He rode on the seat of the 11th wagon with one of the Estrada men. He guessed that Sleitman had a good boy too, which had gone far toward making this the mess that it was. Jake was at the Dogon one night. When you and Andy were there, passing on news of your neighbors, Roland said. On the seat beside him, Sleitman winced like a man who has just been punched in the belly. There, he said. Yes, I could almost sense, or thought I could. A longer pause, and then, fuck. Roland looked east. A little brighter over there now, but still no dust, which was good. Once the dust appeared, the wolves would come in a rush. Their gray horses would be fast. Continuing on, speaking almost idly, Roland asked the other question. If Sleitman answered in the negative, he wouldn't live to see the coming of the wolves, no matter how fast their gray horses rode. If you'd found him, Sleitman, if you'd found my boy, would you have killed him? Sleitman put his spectacles back on as he struggled with it. Roland couldn't tell if he understood the importance of the question or not. He waited to see if the father of Jake's friend would live or die. He'd have to decide quickly. They were approaching the place where the wagons would stop and the children would get down. The man at last raised his head and met Roland's eyes again. He opened his mouth to speak, and couldn't. The fact of the matter was clear enough. He could answer the gunslinger's question, or he could look into the gunslinger's face, but he could not do both at the same time. Dropping his gaze back to the splintery wood between his feet, Sleitman said, "Yes, I reckon we would have killed him." A pause, a nod. When he moved his head, a tear fell from one eye and splashed on the wood of the peak seat's floor. "Yar, what else?" Now he looked up. Now he could meet Roland's eyes again, and when he did, he saw his fate had been decided. "Make it quick," said he, "and don't let me boy see it happen. Beg you, please." Roland flapped the reins over the mules' backs again. Then he said, "I won't be the one to stop your miserable breath." Sleitman's breath did stop. Telling the gunslinger that yes, he would have killed a 12-year-old boy to protect his secret, his face had had a kind of strained nobility. Now it wore hope instead, and hope made it ugly, nearly grotesque. Then he let his breath out in a ragged sigh and said, "You're fooling with me, teasing me. You're going to kill me, all right. Why would you not?" "A coward judges all he sees by what he is," Roland remarked. "I'd not kill you unless I had to, Sleitman, because I love my own boy. You must understand that much, don't you? To love a boy?" "Yar." Sleitman lowered his head again and began to rub the back of his sunburned neck. The neck he must have thought would end this day packed in dirt. "But you have to understand something. For your own good and Benny's as much as ours. If the wolves win, you will die. That much you can be sure of. Take it to the bank, Eddie and Susanna say." Sleitman was looking at him again, eyes narrowed behind his specs. "Hear me well, Sleitman, and take understanding from what I say. We're not going to be where the wolves think we're going to be, and neither are the kiddies.
Win or lose, this time they're going to leave some bodies behind, and win or lose, they'll know they were misled. Who was there in Calibrin Sturgis to mislead them? Only two. Andy and Ben Sleitman. Andy's shut down, gone beyond the reach of their vengeance. He gave Sleitman a smile that was as cold as the Earth's north end. But you're not. Nor the only one you care for in your poor excuse for a heart. Sleitman sat considering this. It was clearly a new idea to him, but once he saw the logic of it, it was undeniable. They'll likely think you switched sides a purpose, Roland said. But even if you could convince them it was an accident, they'd kill you just the same. And your son as well, for vengeance. A red stain had seeped into the man's cheeks as the gunslinger spoke. Roses of shame, Roland supposed. But as he considered the probability of his son's murder at the hands of the wolves, he grew white once more. Or perhaps it was the thought of Benny being taken east that did it, being taken east and ruined.
I'm sorry, he said. Sorry for what I've done.
Balls to your sorry, Roland said. Ka works and the world moves on. Sleitman made no reply. I'm disposed to send you with the kids just as I said I would, Roland told him. If things go as I hope, you won't see a single moment's action. If things don't go as I hope, you want to remember Sari Adams is boss of that shooting match, and if I talk to her after, you want to hope that she says you did everything you were told to do. When this met with only more silence from Sleitman, the gunslinger spoke sharply. Tell me you understand, goddamn you. I want to hear, yes, Roland, I can.
Yes, Roland, I can, very well.
There was a pause.
If we do win, will the Folkin find out, do you reckon? Find out about me?
Not from Andy, they won't, Roland said. His blabber's done, and not from me, if you do as you now promise. Not from my cotet, either. Not out of respect for you, but out of respect for Jake Chambers. And if the wolves fall into the trap I've laid them, why would the Folkin ever suspect another traitor? He measured Sleitman with his cool eyes. They're innocent folk, trusting. As ye know. Certainly ye used it. The flush came back. Sleitman looked down at the floor of the peak seat again. Roland looked up and saw the place he was looking for now less than a quarter of a mile ahead. Good. There was still no dust cloud on the eastern horizon, but he could feel it gathering in his mind. The wolves were coming, oh yes. Somewhere across the river, they had dismounted their train and mounted their horses and were riding like hell. And from it, he had no doubt. I did it for my son, Sleitman said. And he came to me and said they would surely take him. Somewhere over there, Roland, he pointed east toward Thunderclap. Somewhere over there are poor creatures called breakers, prisoners. And he says they're telepaths and psychokinetics, and although I ken neither word, I know they're to do with the mind. The breakers are human, and they eat what we eat to nourish their bodies, but they need other food, special food, to nourish whatever it is that makes them special. Brain food, Roland said. He remembered that his mother had called fish brain food, and then for no reason he could tell, he found himself thinking of Susanna's nocturnal prowls. Only it wasn't Susanna who visited that midnight banquet hall. It was Mia, daughter of none.
Yar, I reckon, Sleitman agreed. Anyway, it's something only twins have, something that links them mind to mind. And these fellows, not the wolves, but they who send the wolves, take it out. When it's gone, the kids are idiots. Ruined. It's food, Roland, do you ken it? That's why they take 'em, to feed their goddamned breakers. Not their bellies or their bodies, but their minds. And I don't even know what it is they've been set to break.
The two beams that still hold the tower, Roland said. Sleitman was thunderstruck and fearful.
The Dark Tower?
He whispered the words.
Do you say so?
I do, Roland said. Who's Finley?
Finley Otego.
I don't know. A voice that takes my reports is all. A Tahin, I think. Do you know what that is?
Do you? Sleitman shook his head. Then we'll leave it. Mayhap I'll meet him in time, and he'll answer to hand for this business.
Sleitman did not reply, but Roland sensed his doubt. That was all right. They'd almost made it now, and the gunslinger felt an invisible band, which had been cinched about his middle, begin to loosen. He turned fully to the foreman for the first time.
There's always been someone like you for Andy to cousin, Sleitman. I have no doubt it's mostly what he was left here for, just as I have no doubt that your daughter, Benny's sister, didn't die an accidental death. They always need one leftover twin. And one weak parent.
You can't—
Shut up. You've said all that's good for you.
Sleitman sat silent beside Roland on the seat. I understand betrayal. I've done my share of it. Once to Jake himself. But that doesn't change what you are. Let's have that straight. You're a carrion bird, a rusty-turned vulture.
The color was back in Sleitman's cheeks, turning them the shade of claret.
I did what I did for my boy, he said stubbornly.
Roland spat into his cupped hand, then raised the hand and caressed Sleitman's cheek with it. The cheek was currently full of blood and hot to the touch. Then the gunslinger took hold of the spectacles Sleitman wore and jiggled them slightly on the man's nose.
Won't wash, he said very quietly, because of these. This is how they mark you, Sleitman. This is your brand. You tell yourself you did it for your boy because it gets you to sleep at night. I tell myself that what I did to Jake, I did so as not to lose my chance at the tower. And that gets me to sleep at night. The difference between us, the only difference, is that I never took a pair of spectacles.
He wiped his hand on his pants.
You sold out, Sleitman. And you have forgotten the face of your father.
Let me be,
Sleitman whispered. He wiped the slick of the gunslinger's spittle from his cheek. It was replaced by his own tears.
For my boy's sake.
Roland nodded. That's all this is. For your boy's sake. You drag him behind you like a dead chicken. Well, never mind. If all goes as I hope, you may live your life with him in the collar and grow old in the regard of your neighbors. You'll be one of those who stood up to the wolves when the gunslingers came to town along the path of the beam. When you can't walk, he'll walk with you and hold you up. I see this, but I don't like what I see, because a man who'll sell his soul for a pair of spectacles will resell it for some other prinkadee, even cheaper. And sooner or later your boy will find out what you are anyway. The best thing that could happen to your son today is for you to die a hero. And then, before Sleitman could reply, Roland raised his voice and shouted,
Hey, Overholzer! Oh, the wagon! Overholzer, pull on over! We're here! Say thank you!
Roland,
Sleitman began.
No, Roland said, tying off the reins. Palaver's done. Just remember what I said, Si. If you get a chance to die a hero today, do your son a favor and take it.
3. At first, everything went according to plan, and they called it Ka. When things began going wrong, and the dying started, they called that Ka, too. Ka, the gunslinger could have told them, was often the last thing you had to rise above. 4. Roland had explained to the children what he wanted of them while still on the common, under the flaring torches. Now, with daylight brightening, but the sun still waiting in the wings, they took their places perfectly, lining up in the road from oldest to youngest, each pair of twins holding hands. The buckas were parked on the left side of the road, their offside wheels just above the ditch. The only gap was where the track into the Arroyo country split off from East Road. Standing beside the children in a stretched line were the minders, their number now swelled to well over a dozen, with the addition of Tian, Per Callahan, Sleitman, and Wayne Overholzer. Across from them, positioned in a line above the right-hand ditch, were Eddie, Susanna, Rosa, Margaret Eisenhart, and Tian's wife Zelia. Each of the women wore a silk-lined reed sack filled with plates. Stacked in the ditch below and behind them were boxes containing more orizas. There were 200 plates in all. Eddie glanced across the river. Still no dust. Susanna gave him a nervous smile, which he returned in kind. This was the hard part, the scary part. Later, he knew, the red fog would wrap him up and carry him away. Now he was too aware. What he was aware of most was that right now they were as helpless and vulnerable as a turtle without its shell. Jake came hustling up the line of children, carrying the box of collected odds and ends, hair ribbons, a teething infant's comfort chewy, a whistle whittled from a U-stick, an old shoe with most of the sole gone, a mateless sock. There were perhaps 2 dozen similar items.
"Benny Sleitman," Roland barked. "Frank Tavery, Francine Tavery, to me."
"Here now," Benny Sleitman's father said, immediately alarmed. "What are you calling my son out of line for?"
"To do his duty just as you'll do yours," Roland said. "Not another word."
The 4 children he had called appeared before him. The Taveries were flushed and out of breath, eyes shining, still holding hands.
"Listen now, and make me repeat not a single word," Roland said.
Benny and the Taveries leaned forward anxiously. Although clearly impatient to be off, Jake was less anxious. He knew this part and most of what would follow. What Roland hoped would follow. Roland spoke to the children, but loud enough for the strung-out line of childminders to hear too.
"You're to go up the path," he said, "and every few feet you leave something, as if 'twere dropped on a hard, fast march. And I expect you for to make a hard, fast march. Don't run, but just below it. Mind your footing. Go to where the path branches, that's 1/2 mile, and no farther. Do you ken? Not 1 step farther.
They nodded eagerly. Roland switched his gaze to the adults standing tensely behind them. "These 4 get a 2-minute start. Then the rest of the twins go, oldest first, youngest last. They won't be going far. The last pairs will hardly get off the road." Roland raised his voice to a commanding shout. "Children, when you hear this, come back. Come to me, a hurry." Roland put the first 2 fingers of his left hand into the corners of his mouth and blew a whistle so piercing that several children put their hands to their ears. Annabel Javier said,
"Sai, if you mean for the children to hide in one of the caves, why would you call them back?"
"Because they're not going into the caves," Roland said. "They're going down there."
He pointed east.
"Lady Oriza is going to take care of the children. They're going to hide in the rice, just this side of the river."
They all looked where he pointed. And so it was, they all saw the dust at the same time. The wolves were coming. 5.
"Our company's on the way, Sugar Pie," Susanna said.
Roland nodded, then turned to Jake. "Go on, Jake. Just as I say." Jake pulled a double handful of stuff from the box and handed it to the Tavery twins. Then he jumped the left-hand ditch, graceful as a deer, and started up the arroyo track with Benny beside him. Frank and Francine were right behind. As Roland watched, Francine let a little hat fall from her hand.
"All right," Overholzer said. "I ken some of it, do you? The wolves'll see the cast-offs and be even surer the kids are up there. But why send the rest of 'em north at all, Gunslinger? Why not just march 'em down to the rice right now?"
"Because we have to assume the wolves can smell the track of prey as well as real wolves," Roland said. He raised his voice again.
"Children, up the path, oldest first. Hold the hand of your partner and don't let go. Come back at my whistle."
The children started off, helped into the ditch by Callahan, Sari Adams, the Javiers, and Ben Sleitman. All the adults looked anxious. Only Benny's Da looked mistrustful as well.
"The wolves will start in because they've reason to believe the children are up there," Roland said. "But they're not fools, Wayne. They'll look for sign, and we'll give it to 'em. If they smell, and I'd bet this town's last rice crop that they do, they'll have scent, as well as dropped shoes and ribbons to look at. After the smell of the main group stops, that of the 4 I sent first will carry on yet a while farther. It may suck 'em in deeper, or it may not. By then, it shouldn't matter. But—"
Roland ignored him. He turned toward his little band of fighters. They would be 7 in all. It's a good number, he told himself. A number of power. He looked beyond them at the dust cloud. It rose higher than any of the remaining Seminon dust devils, and was moving with horrible speed. Yet for the time being, Roland thought they were all right. "Listen and hear." It was Zelia, Margaret, and Rosa to whom he was speaking. The members of his own quartet already knew this part, had since old Jamie whispered his long-held secret into Eddie's ear on the Jaffords' porch. "The wolves are neither men nor monsters. They're robots."
"Robots!"
Overholzer shouted, but with surprise rather than disbelief. "Aye, and of a kind my quartet has seen before," Roland said. He was thinking of a certain clearing where the great bear's final surviving retainers had chased each other in an endless worry circle. "They wear hoods to conceal tiny, twirling things on top of their heads. They're probably this wide and this long." Roland showed them a height of about 2 inches and a length of about 5. "It's what Molly Doolin hit and snapped off with her dish once upon a time. She hit by accident. We'll hit a purpose."
"Thinking caps," Eddie said. "Their connection to the outside world. Without 'em, they're as dead as dog shit."
"Aim here." Roland held his right hand an inch above the crown of his head.
"But the chests, the gills in the chests," Margaret began, sounding utterly bewildered.
"Bullshit now and ever was," Roland said. "Aim at the tops of the hoods."
"Someday," Tian said, "I'm going to know why there had to be so much buggering bullshit."
"I hope there is a someday," Roland said. The last of the children, the youngest ones, were just starting up the path, obediently holding hands. The eldest would be perhaps an eighth of a mile up, Jake's quartet at least an eighth of a mile beyond that. It would have to be enough. Roland turned his attention to the childminders. "Now they come back," he said. "Take them across the ditch and through the corn in 2 side-by-side rows." He cocked a thumb over his shoulder without looking. "Do I have to tell you how important it is that the corn plants not be disturbed? Especially close to the road where the wolves can see." They shook their heads. "At the edge of the rice," Roland continued, "take them into one of the streams, lead them almost to the river, then have them lie down where it's tall and still green." He moved his hands apart, his blue eyes blazing. "Spread 'em out. You grown-ups get on the river side of 'em. If there's trouble, more wolves, something else we don't expect, that's the side it'll come from."
Without giving them a chance to ask questions, Roland buried his fingers in the corners of his mouth again and whistled. Vaughn Eisenhart, Krella Anselm, and Wayne Overholzer joined the others in the ditch and began bellowing for the little ones to turn around and start back toward the road. Eddie, meanwhile, took another look over his shoulder and was stunned to see how far toward the river the dust cloud had progressed. Such rapid movement made perfect sense once you knew the secret. Those gray horses weren't horses at all, but mechanical conveyances disguised to look like horses, no more than that. Like a fleet of government Chevys, he thought.
"Roland, they're coming fast, like hell."
Roland looked. "We're all right," he said.
"Are you sure?" Rosa asked.
"Yes." The youngest children were now hurrying back across the road, hand in hand, bug-eyed with fear and excitement. Cantab of the Manny and Ara, his wife, were leading them. She told them to walk straight down the middle of the rows and try not to even brush any of the skeletal plants.
"Why, Si?"
asked one tyke, surely no older than 4. There was a suspicious dark patch on the front of his overalls.
"Corn all picked, see?"
"It's a game," Cantab said. "A don't-touch-the-corn game." He began to sing. Some of the children joined in, but most were too bewildered and frightened. As the pairs crossed the road, growing taller and older as they came, Roland cast another glance to the east. He estimated the wolves were still 10 minutes from the other side of the Hwy, and 10 minutes should be enough, but gods, they were fast. It had already crossed his mind that he might have to keep Slightman the Younger and the Tavery twins up here with them. It wasn't in the plan, but by the time things got this far, the plan almost always started to change, had to change. Now the last of the kids were crossing, and only Overholzer, Callahan, Slightman the Elder, and Sari Adams were still on the road.
"Go," Roland told them.
"I want to wait for my boy," Slightman objected.
"Go!"
Slightman looked disposed to argue the point, but Sari Adams touched one elbow, and Overholzer actually took hold of the other. "Come ye,"
Overholzer said. The man'll take care of yours, same as he'll take care of his.
Sleitman gave Roland a final, doubtful look, then stepped over the ditch and began herding the tail end of the line downhill, along with Overholzer and Sari.
Susanna, show them the hide, Roland said.
They'd been careful to make sure the kids crossed the ditch on the road's riverside, well down from where they had done their digging the day before. Now, using one of her capped and shortened legs, Susanna kicked aside a tangle of leaves, branches, and dead corn plants, the sort of thing one would expect to see left behind in a roadside runoff ditch, and exposed a dark hole.
"It's just a trench," she said, almost apologetically. "There's boards over the top, light ones, easy to push back. That's where we'll be. Roland's made a... oh, I don't know what you call it. We call it a periscope where I come from, a thing with mirrors inside it you can see through. And when the time comes, we just stand up. The boards'll fall away around us when we do."
"Where's Jake and those other three?" Eddie asked. "They should be back by now."
"It's too soon," Roland said. "Calm down, Eddie."
"I won't calm down, and it's not too soon. We should at least be able to see them. I'm going over there."
"No, you're not," Roland said. "We have to get as many as we can before they figure out what's going on. That means keeping our firepower over here at their backs."
"Roland, something's not right."
Roland ignored him. "Ladies' size, slide in there, do you please? The extra boxes of plates will be on your end. We'll just kick some leaves over them."
He looked across the road, Azalea, Rosa, and Margaret began to worm into the hole Susanna had disclosed. The path to the arroyo was now completely empty. There was still no sign of Jake, Benny, and the Tavery twins. He was beginning to think that Eddie was right, that something had gone amiss. 6. Jake and his companions reached the place where the trail split, quickly and without incident. Jake had held back two items, and when they reached the fork, he threw a broken rattle toward the Gloria and a little girl's woven string bracelet toward the Redbird.
"Choose," he thought, "and be damned to you either way."
When he turned, he saw the Tavery twins had already started back. Benny was waiting for him, his face pale and his eyes shining. Jake nodded to him and made himself return Benny's smile.
"Let's go," he said.
Then they heard Roland's whistle, and the twins broke into a run, despite the scree and fallen rock which littered the path. They were still holding hands, weaving their way around what they couldn't simply scramble over.
"Hey, don't run!" Jake shouted. "He said not to run, and mind your f—"
That was when Frank Tavery stepped into the hole. Jake heard the grinding, snapping sound his ankle made when it broke, knew from the horrified wince on Benny's face that he had too. Then Frank let out a low, screaming moan and pitched sideways. Francine grabbed for him and got a hand on his upper arm, but the boy was too heavy. He fell through her grip like a sash weight. The thud of his skull colliding with the granite outcrop beside him was far louder than the sound his ankle had made. The blood which immediately began to flow from the wound in his scalp was brilliant in the early morning light.
"Trouble," Jake thought, "and in our road."
Benny was gaping, his cheeks the color of cottage cheese. Francine was already kneeling beside her brother, who lay at a twisted, ugly angle with his foot still caught in the hole. She was making high, breathless keening sounds. Then, all at once, the keening stopped. Her eyes rolled up in their sockets, and she pitched forward over her unconscious twin brother in a dead faint.
"Come on," Jake said, and when Benny only stood there, gawping, Jake punched him in the shoulder. "For your father's sake!"
That got Benny moving. 7. Jake saw everything with a gunslinger's cold, clear vision. The blood splashed on the rock, the clump of hair stuck in it, the foot in the hole, the spittle on Frank Tavery's lips, the swell of his sister's new breast as she lay awkwardly across him. The wolves were coming now. It wasn't Roland's whistle that told him this, but the touch.
"Eddie," he thought. "Eddie wants to come over here."
Jake had never tried using the touch to send, but he did now.
"Stay where you are. If we can't get back in time, we'll try to hide while they go past. But don't you come down here. Don't you spoil things."
He had no idea if the message got through, but he did know it was all he had time for. Meanwhile, Benny was...
what? What was Limoges?
Miss Avery, back at Piper, had been very big on les mots justes, and it came to him. Gibbering. Benny was gibbering.
What are we going to do, Jake? Man, Jesus, both of them. They were fine, just running, and then what if the wolves come? What if they come while we're still here? We better leave them, don't you think?
We're not leaving them, Jake said. He leaned down and grabbed Francine Tavery by the shoulders. He yanked her into a sitting position, mostly to get her off her brother so Frank could breathe. Her head lolled back, her hair streaming like dark silk, her eyelids fluttered, showing glabrous white beneath. Without thinking, Jake slapped her, and hard.
"Ow! Ow!"
Her eyes flew open, blue and beautiful and shocked.
"Get up!" Jake shouted. "Get off him!"
How much time had passed? How still everything was, now that the children had gone back to the road. Not a single bird cried out, not even a rusty. He waited for Roland to whistle again, but Roland didn't. And really, why would he? They were on their own now. Francine rolled aside, then staggered to her feet.
"Help him, please, Si, I beg.
Benny, we have to get his foot out of the hole." Benny dropped to one knee on the other side of the awkwardly sprawled boy. His face was still pale, but his lips were pressed together in a tight, straight line that Jake found encouraging.
"Take his shoulder."
Benny grasped Frank Tavery's right shoulder. Jake took the left. Their eyes met across the unconscious boy's body. Jake nodded.
"Now."
They pulled together. Frank Tavery's eyes flew open. They were as blue and as beautiful as his sister's, and he uttered a scream so high it was soundless. But his foot did not come free. It was stuck, deep. 8. Now a gray-green shape was resolving itself out of the dust cloud, and they could hear the drumming of many hooves on Hardpan. The three Kala women were in the hide. Only Roland, Eddie, and Susanna still remained in the ditch, the men standing, Susanna kneeling with her strong thighs spread. They stared across the road and up the arroyo path. The path was still empty.
"I heard something," Susanna said. "I think one of them's hurt."
"Fuck it, Roland, I'm going after them," Eddie said. "Is that what Jake wants or what you want?" Roland asked. Eddie flushed. He had heard Jake in his head, not the exact words, but the gist. And he supposed Roland had too. "There's 100 kids down there and only 4 over there," Roland said. "Get under cover, Eddie. You too, Susanna."
"What about you?"
Eddie asked. Roland pulled in a deep breath, let it out. "I'll help if I can."
"You're not going after him, are you?"
Eddie looked at Roland with mounting disbelief.
"You're really not?"
Roland glanced toward the dust cloud and the gray-green cluster beneath it, which would resolve itself into individual horses and riders in less than a minute. Riders with snarling wolf faces framed in green hoods. They weren't riding toward the river so much as they were swooping down on it.
"No," Roland said. "Can't. Get under cover."
Eddie stood where he was a moment longer, hand on the butt of the big revolver, pale face working. Then, without a word, he turned from Roland and grasped Susanna's arm. He knelt beside her, then slid into the hole. Now there was only Roland, the big revolver slung low on his left hip, looking across the road at the empty arroyo path. 9. Benny Sleitman was a well-built lad, but he couldn't move the chunk of rock holding the Tavery boy's foot. Jake saw that on the first pull. His mind, his cold, cold mind, tried to judge the weight of the imprisoned boy against the weight of the imprisoning stone. He guessed the stone weighed more.
"Francine."
She looked at him from eyes which were now wet and a little blinded by shock.
"You love him?"
Jake asked.
"Aye, with all my heart."
"He is your heart," Jake thought.
"Good. Then help us. Pull him as hard as you can when I say. Never mind if he screams. Pull him anyway."
She nodded as if she understood. Jake hoped she did.
"If we can't get him out this time, we'll have to leave him. I'll never," she shouted.
It was no time for argument. Jake joined Benny beside the flat white rock. Beyond its jagged edge, Frank's bloody shin disappeared into a black hole. The boy was fully awake now and gasping. His left eye rolled in terror. The right one was buried in a sheet of blood. A flap of scalp was hanging over his ear.
"We're going to lift the rock and you're going to pull him out," Jake told Francine. "On three. You ready?"
When she nodded, Her hair fell across her face in a curtain. She made no attempt to get it out of the way, only seized her brother beneath the armpits.
"Francie, don't hurt me," he moaned.
"Shut up," she said.
"One," Jake said. "You pull this fucker, Benny, even if it pops your balls, you hear me? You're buggered, just count. Two. Three."
They pulled, crying out at the strain. The rock moved. Francine yanked her brother backward with all her force, also crying out. Frank Tavery's scream, as his foot came free, was loudest of all. 10. Roland heard hoarse cries of effort, overtopped by a scream of pure agony. Something had happened over there, and Jake had done something about it. The question was, had it been enough to put right whatever had gone wrong? Spray flew in the morning light as the wolves plunged into the Y and began galloping across on their gray horses. Roland could see them clearly now, coming in waves of 5 and 6, spurring their mounts. He put the number at 60. On the far side of the river, they'd disappear beneath the shoulder of a grass-covered bluff, then they'd reappear less than a mile away. They would disappear one last time, behind one final hill, all of them, if they stayed bunched up as they were now, and that would be the last chance for Jake to come, for all of them to get under cover. He stared up the path, willing the children to appear, willing Jake to appear. But the path remained empty. Wolves streaming up the west bank of the river now, their horses casting off showers of droplets which glittered in the morning sun like gold. Clods of earth and sprays of sand flew. Now the hoofbeats were an approaching thunder. 11. Jake took one shoulder, Benny the other. They carried Frank Tavery down the path that way, plunging ahead with reckless speed, hardly even looking down at the tumbles of rock. Francine ran just behind them. They came around the final curve, and Jake felt a surge of gladness when he saw Roland in the ditch opposite, still Roland, standing watch with his good left hand on the butt of his gun and his hat tipped back from his brow.
"It's my brother," Francine was shouting at him. "He fell down. He got his foot caught in a hole."
Roland suddenly dropped out of sight. Francine looked around, not frightened exactly, but uncomprehending.
"What?
Wait," Jake said, because that was all he knew to say. He had no other ideas. If that was true of the gunslinger as well, they'd probably die here.
"My ankle, burning," Frank Tavery gasped.
"Shut up," Jake said. Then he laughed. It was shock laughter, but it was also real laughter. Jake looked at him, around the sobbing, bleeding Frank Tavery, and winked. Benny winked back. And just like that, they were friends again. 12. As she lay in the darkness of the hide, with Eddie on her left and the acrid smell of leaves in her nose, Susanna felt a sudden cramp seize her belly. She had just time to register it before an ice pick of pain, blue and savage, plunged into the left side of her brain, seeming to numb that entire side of her face and neck. At the same instant, the image of a great banquet hall filled her mind. Steaming roasts, stuffed fish, smoking steaks, magnums of champagne, frigates filled with gravy, rivers of red wine. She heard a piano and a singing voice. That voice was charged with an awful sadness. "Someone saved, someone saved, someone saved my life tonight," it sang.
"No!"
Susanna cried to the force that was trying to engulf her. And did that force have a name? Of course it did. Its name was Mother. Its hand was the one that rocked the cradle, and the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world.
"No, you have to let me finish this. Afterward, if you want to have it, I'll help you. I'll help you have it. But if you try to force this on me now, I'll fight you tooth and nail. And if it comes to getting myself killed and killing your precious chap along with me, I'll do it. Do you hear me, you bitch?"
For a moment there was nothing but the darkness. The press of Eddie's leg, the numbness in the left side of her face, the thunder of the oncoming horses, the acrid smell of the leaves, and the sound of the sisters breathing, getting ready for their own battle. Then each of her words articulated clearly from a place above and behind Susanna's left eye. Mia, for the first time, spoke to her.
"Fight your fight, woman. I'll even help if I can. And then, keep your promise."
"Susanna?" Eddie murmured from beside her. Are you all right?
Yes, she said, and she was.
The ice pick was gone. The voice was gone. So was the terrible numbness. But close by, Mia was waiting. 13. Roland lay on his belly in the ditch, now watching the wolves with one eye of imagination and one of intuition instead of with those in his head. The wolves were between the bluff and the hill, riding full out with their cloaks streaming behind them. They'd all disappear behind the hill for perhaps 7 seconds, if, that was, they stayed bunched together and the leaders didn't start to pull ahead. If he had calculated their speed correctly, if he was right, he'd have 5 seconds when he could motion Jake and the others to come, or 7. If he was right, they'd have those same 5 seconds to cross the road. If he was wrong, or if the others were slow, the wolves would either see the man in the ditch, the children in the road, or all of them. The distances would likely be too great to use their weapons, but that wouldn't much matter because the carefully crafted ambush would be blown. The smart thing would be to stay down and leave the kids over there to their fate. Hell, 4 kids caught on the Arroyo path would make the wolves more sure than ever that the rest of them were stashed farther on in one of the old mines.
Enough thinking, Cort said in his head. If you mean to move, Maggot, this is your only chance.
Roland shot to his feet. Directly across from him, protected by the cluster of tumbled boulders which marked the east road end of the Arroyo path, stood Jake and Benny Sleitman, with the Tavery boy supported between them. The kid was bloody both north and south. Gods knew what had happened to him. His sister was looking over his shoulder. In that instant they looked not just like twins, but Caffin twins, joined at the body. Roland jerked both hands extravagantly back over his head, as if clawing for a grip in the air. To me, come, come! At the same time he looked east. No sign of the wolves. Good, the hill had momentarily blocked them all. Jake and Benny sprinted across the road, still dragging the boy between them. Frank Tavery's shore boots dug fresh grooves in the oggin. Roland could only hope the wolves would attach no especial significance to the marks. The girl came last, light as a sprite. Down! Roland snarled, grabbing her shoulder and throwing her flat. Down, down, down! He landed beside her, and Jake landed on top of him. Roland could feel the boy's madly beating heart between his shoulder blades, through both of their shirts, and had a moment to relish the sensation. Now the hoofbeats were coming hard and strong, swelling every second. Had they been seen by the lead riders? It was impossible to know, but they would know, and soon. In the meantime, they could only go on as planned. It would be tight quarters in the hide, with 3 extra people in there, and if the wolves had seen Jake and the other 3 crossing the road, they would all no doubt be cooked where they lay without a single shot fired or plate thrown. But there was no time to worry about that now. They had 1 minute left at most, Roland estimated, maybe only 40 seconds. And that last little bit of time was melting away beneath them. Get off me and under cover, he said to Jake, right now. The weight disappeared. Jake slipped into the hide. You're next, Frank Tavery, Roland said, and be quiet. 2 minutes from now, you can scream all you want, but for now, keep your mouth shut. That goes for all of you.
I'll be quiet, the boy said huskily.
Benny and Frank's sister nodded. We're going to stand up at some point and start shooting, Roland said. You 3, Frank, Francine, Benny, stay down. Stay flat. He paused. For your lives, stay out of our way. 14. Roland lay in the leaf and dirt-smelling dark, listening to the harsh breathing of the children on his left. This sound was soon overwhelmed by that of approaching hooves. The eye of imagination and that of intuition opened once more, and wider than ever. In no more than 30 seconds, perhaps as few as 15, the red rage of battle would do away with all but the most primitive seeing, but for now he saw all, and all he saw was exactly as he wanted it to be. And why not? What good did visualizing plans gone astray ever do anyone? He saw the twins of the Kala lying sprawled like corpses in the thickest, wettest part of the rice, with the muck oozing through their shirts and pants. He saw the adults beyond them, almost to the place where rice became riverbank. he saw Sari Adams with her plates and Ara of the Manny, Cantab's wife, with a few of her own, for Ara also threw, although as one of the Manny folk she could never be at fellowship with the other women. He saw a couple of the men, Estrada, Anselm, Overholzer, with their bas hugged to their chests. Instead of a bas, Vaughn Eisenhart was hugging the rifle Roland had cleaned for him. In the road, approaching from the east, he saw rank upon rank of green-cloaked riders on grey horses. They were slowing now. The sun was finally up and gleaming on the metal of their masks. The joke of those masks, of course, was that there was more metal beneath them. Roland let the eye of his imagining rise, looking for other riders, a party coming into the undefended town from the south, for instance. He saw none. In his own mind, at least, the entire raiding party was here. And if they'd swallowed the line Roland and the quartet of the 90 and 9 had paid out with such care, it should be here. He saw the bucka wagons lined up on the town side of the road, and had time to wish they'd freed the teams from the traces, but of course this way it looked better, more hurried. He saw the path leading into the arroyos, to the mines both abandoned and working, to the honeycomb of caves beyond them. He saw the leading wolves rein up here, dragging the mouths of their mounts into snarls with their gauntleted hands. He saw through their eyes, saw pictures not made of warm human sight but cold, like those in the magazines. Saw the child's hat Francine Tavery had let drop. His mind had a nose as well as an eye, and it smelled the bland yet fecund aroma of children. It smelled something rich and fatty, the stuff the wolves would take from the children they abducted. His mind had an ear as well as a nose, and it heard, faintly, the same sort of clicks and clunks that had emanated from Andy, the same low whining of relays, servo motors, hydraulic pumps, gods knew what other machinery. His mind's eye saw the wolves first inspecting the confusion of tracks on the road. He hoped it looked like a confusion to them. Then looking up the arroyo path. Because imagining them looking the other way, getting ready to broil the 10 of them in their hide like chickens in a roasting pan, would do him no good. No, they were looking up the arroyo path. Must be looking up the arroyo path. They were smelling children. Perhaps their fear as well as the powerful stuff buried deep in their brains. And seeing the few tumbled bits of trash and treasure their prey had left behind. Standing there on their mechanical horses, looking. "Go in," Roland urged silently. He felt Jake stir a little beside him, hearing his thought, his prayer almost. "Go in. Go after them. Take what you will." There was a loud clack sound from one of the wolves. This was followed by a brief blurt of siren. The siren was followed by the nasty warbling whistle Jake had heard out at the Dogon. After that the horses began to move again. First there was the soft thud of their hoofs on the Ogun, then on the far stonier ground of the arroyo path. There was nothing else. These horses didn't whinny nervously, like those still harnessed to the buckas. For Roland it was enough. They had taken the bait. He slipped his revolver out of its holster. Beside him, Jake shifted again, and Roland knew he was doing the same thing. He had told them the formation to expect when they burst out of the hide. About a quarter of the wolves on one side of the path, looking toward the river, a quarter of their number turned toward the town of Calabrin Sturgis. Or perhaps a few more in that direction, since if there was trouble, the town was where the wolves, or the wolves' programmers, would reasonably expect it to come from. And the rest, 30 or more, already up the path, hemmed in, do ya? Roland began counting to 20, but when he got to 19, decided he'd counted enough. He gathered his legs beneath him. There was no dry twist now, not so much as a twinge. And then pistoned upward with his father's gun held high in his hand. "For Gilead and Akala!" he roared. "Now, gunslingers! Now, you sisters of Oriza! Now! Now! Kill them! No quarter! Kill them all!"